Our Father in heaven, we thank you for giving us this opportunity to meet together. We pray that what we will be discussing, what we'll be seeing and even thinking about while we're here will be inspired by the Holy Spirit and will make a difference in how we approach our practice henceforth. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. Okay, first need to start with a disclosure. I have one disclosure, and that is that I am a physician Christian. I didn't say a Christian physician, I said a physician Christian. Christian is the noun, physician is the adjective, all right? Maybe you can ask me about that later on if you want to find out more. In front of you, you have an article. And that article was taken from the Washington Post, written by an infectious disease specialist who had an encounter with a patient. Now, I need to get a copy of one so that I don't make any mistakes about what I'm saying. Thank you. In this article, the doctor was pointing out what happened as he was speaking with a patient who had just been seen by an oncologist. And in talking to the patient, he tried to get some feedback as to how things were going because this patient had just been given the diagnosis, a terrible diagnosis, of end-stage pancreatic cancer. That's okay. All right, nobody will get hurt here, that's for sure. Thank you. Yes, so he was surprised at what happened as he asked the patient about how it went when the oncologist was there. And I refer to this, it's about just below halfway of the page. He said, I asked, when you were told your diagnosis of cancer, what went through your mind? Sitting back by his bedside, I expected to hear the usual description of shock or denial. But his case was different. Well, this is what the patient is saying. Well, the first thing I wanted to do was, I wish I was 10 years younger. I would have reached across and slapped the out of that doctor. Despite his words, he didn't look angry, just deeply saddened. Startled, I asked why. He told me that the specialist had pulled out a piece of paper with his biopsy results and said, well, this doesn't look very good. This is terminal. He didn't talk to me. He talked to a piece of paper. I got a guy sitting here reading the piece of paper telling me I'm going to die, then walking out the door. That was not well executed. To him, the heartlessness of the doctor's presentation was as painful as the news. Hearing this scathing critique, I broke out in a sweat. I could easily imagine myself on a busy day informing a patient of something similar. I would suppose that you have had some encounters, maybe not personally, because, you know, we're all, you know, great doctors here, right? The best doctors, right in this room. But you may have had some opportunity in working with patients that you weren't at your best and you didn't communicate your care and concern the way you probably should have. What I took out of this paper, and it's actually 3 pages long, I just did the first page because that's where the poignant activity is. There were some key observations that I made. Okay. And it's this. This is not just from the paper, it's what I have lived as a physician. What you do is important. Can I have testimony to that? What you do is important. But how you do what you do is also very important. You know, as an attending, the way you talk to the residents, the way you talk to the students, the way you talk to the nurses, the way you talk to the family, how you respond when somebody asks you a question for the 15th time that you thought you had answered well before. How you do those things is also important. Patient feedback is valuable. To have a patient who's able to tell you how you're doing, right? Or, you know, doc, this morning when you came in on rounds, I could tell something was going on with you. I thought it was hidden. I didn't know people could see. I didn't know the patients would feel this. But self-reflection is essential. And this doctor who wrote the article, he had opportunity to reflect on what he was doing and how he had been doing his work. So I'm going to ask you, what in your practice gets in the way of your being compassionate? Would you just take half a minute and tell the person next to you what in your practice seems to be the big issue? Go ahead. You're free to talk. We have 30 seconds. Okay. Would someone want to just speak out loud? I'll repeat it so that everybody can hear, if everybody wouldn't be able to hear what you say. What are some of the things that come to your mind?
Time.
Time. Yeah. Just too much to do and too little time, right? Anybody else? Is time a big one for everybody? Yeah? Okay. What else? Anything different from that?
Pressure.
Yeah. You have people who are waiting. You have stuff to do. You need to get this done. It's, again, time pressures, right? Anything else? What were they here? Difficult patients. Yeah. Or rude patients, right? Preconceived ideas about what was going to happen, right? You prejudged the situation, and it turned out to be something different. Okay. Now, I noticed nobody here said anything about computer monitors or computer screens. That's understood. That's a given these days, right? Yeah. Well, you know, all of these things, the literature supports many of these things as being obstacles to being compassionate or spending time or more time or more quality time with patients. But I want to draw your attention to some research that was done back in the 70s that looked at something that is similar. This is the Darley-Batson experiment. Anybody knows about the Darley-Batson experiment? Well, you're going to know about it today, all right? What they were doing, these two researchers, they were looking at individual subjects who they wanted to see if they would be acting in a helpful way. We can translate that helpful way to being compassionate towards somebody else. They looked at the task that these individuals were going to be assigned. They looked at their religiousness. They looked at their religiousness in looking at a scale of religiosity and ethical thoughts. And they also looked at time pressure on the individuals to see if these things would affect how helpful they would be to somebody who was obviously in distress. The whole study actually took 3 days to complete because they had these subjects who were students. They had them come first to one place, they'd give them instructions, they'd go to another place, they would get instructions there, and then they were to go to the final place to deliver some messages. Now, half of these individuals were told that the message that they were going to give was the message of the Good Samaritan. So they were all familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan. So this was in their mind, the idea of being willing and able to help. The others were told that they were going to be talking about something vocational, right? And they didn't know that they were being tested because there were confederates, actors that were on the way where all of these students individually would have to pass. And the individuals who were there, the actors, they were people who were slumped over, obviously in distress. In a couple of cases, the actors really went overboard and they really made the case that they were in trouble. Okay? And then the question was, would any of these variables correlate with more or less helpful behavior? They had one other condition. They told half of the group that the people who you're going to be giving the talk with, that you had to record, they are waiting for you already. Okay, so hurry over there and get that done. The others are told, you still have some time, so you can get your thoughts together and whatnot and get over there. All right? So there was a group that was the high-hurried individuals, and the others who were not hurried. And actually, at the end of the experiment, they were able to stratify people into high hurry, medium hurry, and low hurry individuals. And they looked at correlations with their helpfulness. They thought, well, maybe those who are going to talk about the Good Samaritan, because that's on their minds, they would be able to be more helpful because they would be faced with a situation that is what they were going to be talking about. Well, the people who were going to talk about the Good Samaritan, only 53% of them stopped along the way to offer any kind of help to the person who was in distress, the actor. But when you compare that with the others who weren't thinking those thoughts, it was 29% of them helped. Okay, so it did have some effect, but we're looking at half of the people, okay, not paying attention. As a matter of fact, at the end of the study, they even looked at whether the individuals acknowledged that there was somebody on the ground. Some people passed by and they didn't even notice that there was someone in distress. As a matter of fact, they commented on several cases where people stepped over the person in distress and did not stop to offer any kind of help. The greatest impact on whether they were going to stop or not or offer help was hurriedness. Low hurry, 63% of those individuals offered help. Medium hurry, 45% offered help. High hurry, only 10% offered help. Hurriedness. Hurriedness. People with a high hurry, therefore, are least helpful. Are you hurried, not just harried, in your practice, in the hospital, or wherever it is that you see patients or attend to people? What was interesting is that people who were religious or who had a particular religious orientation, that did not impact whether they stopped or not. Isn't that something? What I didn't tell you is that all of these students were fourth-year seminarians. You didn't get that. I expected to get a or something. They were fourth-year seminarians. They're getting ready to go out into the pastoral world. Yep. A person in a hurry is less likely to help people. That is, they show less compassion, even when going to speak about the Good Samaritan. So this experiment has some implications for healthcare practice today. Hurriedness, as opposed to just busyness, is an enemy of helpfulness. And hurriedness narrows your focus and my focus and may blur the perception of suffering. When we're hurried, we don't see. Our focus is somewhere else. And that issue of focus brings us to a statement that Ellen White said. She says in Ministry of Healing, chapter 15, all hurry, excitement, or confusion should be avoided. She was talking about physicians. You know, she even goes on to point out that our most important function as Adventists is not just the healing of the body, but the care of the soul. How do you reconcile that with all of the busy things that we have to do and the fact that we might be called, and in today's day, we might be paged and we may have these direct communication devices and whatnot, all everybody clamoring for our attention at the same time. How do you reconcile these things? Well, there was a very interesting book written some years ago that was called The Tyranny of the Urgent. Some of you may remember that book. It stratified things into various columns. And just for purposes of illustration, we can look at this two-by-two diagram. People can look at urgent things on the horizontal axis and important things on the vertical axis. Well, depending on which quadrant your activity might be, should determine to us which ones we're going to do immediately, which ones we can put off, which ones we may never have to do. What's interesting is that subsequent research to having this book available to people, it was found that quadrant, I think it's the right lower quadrant, non-urgent and non-important, that's the quadrant that many people seem to spend a lot of time in. Why? Because those things oftentimes were fun, or at least not as onerous as the others. And therefore, it pushed things from the other quadrants into that upper left quadrant when things became not just important, but they became urgent to do as well. We should be, therefore, according to the author of this book and his subsequent book, taking care of the urgent and important things, but never neglecting the important things. And sometimes things that are urgent but not important eclipse those things that are important but not urgent. When we err, we should err on the side of the important, not the urgent. But of course, if it's urgent and important, that takes the highest priority. So, how do we focus our days in what to do? Well, we have Jesus' example. What did he do? He spent time in the wee hours of the morning communing with his Father. And God set his daily agenda. You know, that's something that we should practice. Why? Because we're people. We are disciples, and because we are busy. We couldn't be more busy than Jesus. And if Jesus needed to get instructions for his agenda for the day from his dad, shouldn't we? So what are you focusing on? What do I focus on when I start my day? Who are you focusing on? When you're seeing patient X, doesn't matter which order you're seeing the patient, but when you're seeing patient X, who are you focused on? Are you focused on you, on the next patient, on what else you have to do, on what's going on at home, what's going on somewhere else, or are you focusing on that patient at the time? I would suggest that for the sake of being compassionate, we should be focusing on the patient, but not only the patient, and you'll see why later on. Where is your focus? Is it here? Is it in the here and now? Or is it focused on something else? Well, you know, as Christians, we have to be in the present, but we're always looking at the future. You know, I remember covering for a patient in the hospital, and I'm not going to give you the details. I didn't have to go and see that patient at that time. The patient was going to be transferred over to the surgical ward. I wasn't going to be paid for seeing the patient, but something said, go by and see her. I went by and I saw her, and we talked a little bit, and I sat down next to her, and she was anxious about having to go to surgery. She was going to go off the internal medicine service into the surgical. And, you know, I asked if she would like us to pray together, and she said yes, that would be very nice. And we did. We had a little season of prayer, and then I left. I had never seen this patient before because I didn't know her. And while I was still in the hospital, her mom came by. She wanted to see me, and she said, "Thank you so much for praying with my daughter. I think it eased her mind." Yeah, I thought, well, yeah, thank you, Lord. That was a good call. That was a good call. And then later on, I found out that she never made it out of surgery. I was very thankful that I had a chance to pray with her. I could have been doing all kinds of other things. And I probably wouldn't even have known what happened to her because she was being transferred to the care of another physician. But I'm glad that I did what I did. But I have to ask myself, how many people have I overlooked being able to spend a moment with them? And I say a moment, how much is a moment? Well, you know, you say, even if it's a few seconds, even if it's just 1 minute, it adds up over the course of the day. So maybe it's not worth spending the few minutes. Maybe it's just not worth it. Somebody else might be able to do that. Somebody who's less busy, less hurried, who has less stuff to do than I do today. So where's my focus? Where's your focus? Why are we doing what we're doing in the first place? Why are we physicians or other healthcare practitioners? Why are we doing this? Is it just a business? Is it just a job? Is it a calling? Is it a responsibility that we have? And I'm not trying to lay a guilt trip on you. I'm just asking you. It's good to reflect on that, and it has helped me, even in what I'm doing now, which is not direct patient care. Why am I doing what I'm doing? Is this what God has called me to do for this season, for this day? You know, there's been a current interest in compassion and compassionate care. I was in medical school in the 1970s. Yes, I'm old. And in those days, I had an issue with what we were being taught. I wasn't extremely vocal about it, but many of my professors, they were insistent on the current or the then current idea of empathy, which was a detached concern for patients, as opposed to sympathy, where you enter into this, you know, emotional morass with your patient, or even compassion, where you had an emotional component of your working with people. Now, it's interesting that they would, I found a problem, because they would tell us one thing, but when I saw them, how they practiced, they were compassionate individuals. But the dogma at that time was that you had to teach this distance from your patients. Those of you who trained in those days would probably remember the exams talked about empathy, not about compassion. And I thought, this is a failing. We should be more involved in what's going on with our patients. And this is what you're doing. I confronted one of my professors. This is what you're doing, and you're telling us another thing. He said, well, what I am doing, you won't find on the exams. Yeah. You know, there was a study report in the UK where they found gross atrocities. People not only neglecting patients, but actually abusing patients. This led to a revolution, if you will, in the National Health Service in the UK. They decided that they had to make a difference, and they had to change the orientation of healthcare providers in terms of being more compassionate with those who they were serving. In America, similar things were found. You would even find, not just in this article that we read at the beginning, but in the medical literature and in the lay press, lack of compassion in caregiving and the need to improve compassion among caregivers. As a matter of fact, things changed in the United States and Canada. They now see that it's a core component, a vital component, that physicians in particular need to provide. So this has become part of the revised curricula in medical schools across the United States and Canada, in the UK, and really around the world. This editorial should alert us. Should physicians be empathetic? Rethinking clinical empathy. What this author said, they highlighted things. Affective resonance may serve more as a liability than as a benefit in the clinical setting. In other words, if we get too close to our patients, we may lack the objectivity to be able to take care of them. Now, what he actually ended up advocating was that we do have this affective part, but that we have to be careful about that, because that can lead us into doing things or not doing things that we should, or doing things that we shouldn't do. The second highlighted thing, he said, the ideal account of empathy in medicine remains cognitive. In other words, the affective part has to be subordinate to the cognitive idea, that we're looking at the patient and we're thinking about what is going on with the patient. And I would agree that we have to be thinking about the patient. But you know, what compassion is even up for grabs. Because the literature is just filled with all these various definitions of what is compassion, what is empathy. It's hard even to study the thing. But this working definition I have found to be very useful. A virtuous and intentional response to know a person, to discern their needs, and to ameliorate their suffering through relational understanding and action. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a good working definition of compassion? Is this what Jesus calls us to do? To be virtuous? To be intentional? Was the Good Samaritan intentional and virtuous? Did he take the time, seeing the suffering of the man on the road on that way to Jericho, to take care of him as best he could? So we have all these definitions. Clinical empathy or empathetic concern. In this article, they point out that the current Western medical culture is very well known for its scientific rigor and its emphasis on objectivity and emotional detachment. You know, studies done back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s point out patients in the United States consistently complain about their doctors not being personable, not being interested in their suffering and their pain. In other words, they're too hurried to pay attention to what's going on with them as a person. What the attorneys have found out in their research is that when someone, even if they receive superb technical care, 90% of the lawsuits revolve around the doctor not paying attention to the softer things. Having a problem in communicating that he or she cares about what happens to the patient. So the technical expertise, wonderful. But if we're not humane in our dealing with patients, we're more likely to be involved in a malpractice lawsuit. That's hard data from the lawyers. So Adventist Healthcare Risk Management used to give seminars for doctors, for Adventist doctors in particular, on how we can be better at avoiding lawsuits. And the number one issue in their training was take a little time to see your patient as a person. Not just as a number, not just as a diagnosis. It's not the gallbladder in room 35. That person there is somebody's mom, somebody's sister, somebody's daughter, somebody's friend. But you know, where did this thing happen? Where did this thing start? There were issues in the early 1900s between these two men. The one on the left is Dr. William Osler. The one on the right is Flexner. Osler and his colleagues, in particular, Dr. Peabody, and there's a beautiful article on the care of the patient. If you would like to get a copy of it, I'd be happy to send you one It's Peabody, who was the Harvard chief of medicine at the Boston College. He gave a wonderful talk. Basically, what he said is the secret of caring for patients is caring for them. The secret of caring for them is actually caring for them. Anyway, he and Osler had some ideas about how to take care of people. What the issue of doctoring has to do with what happens at the bedside. The whole idea of the bedside, not the computer side, right? Not behind the desk, but rather face to face with the person who is suffering. They had a very intense view of illness as opposed to disease. Patients were ill whether or not they had a disease. Whereas Flexner, who was not a physician, who didn't have any degree or license or anything in medicine, his idea was that medical care and doctoring should be very scientific. Not too much with this, you know, soft duty kind of stuff, you know. The science and the rigor. Because at his time, there were lots of, you know, nonsense that was going on in medicine. Somebody would go and take an apprentice course for, you know, 3 weeks to 3 months, and they'd be called a doctor. So he was very, very much in, you know, there needs to be standards, and people need to have certain things that they learn before you can say that they're a doctor. And he was very much in favor of licensure, and he was very much in favor of the rigors of study before you can be approved to be a physician. We have benefited from that. But he also had some other issues that were downsides. This is just a list of some of the things on both sides of the fence. Okay, on the Osler side, the crucial vector is from the bedside to the laboratory, not the other way around. You know, I am noticing today, in some quarters, it's going the reverse. It's the laboratory, right? As a matter of fact, there are some people you cannot get a referral to them unless you send the labs. Okay, they will not see the patient. We have a situation where this one came close to home. It's a friend that I had a woman, friend of the family, who had ascites. And one of my friends, actually somebody who was a student of mine years ago, was the one who was seeing this patient. And he never once touched her. Not once. A postmenopausal woman with ascites. A Seventh-day Adventist who doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, doesn't do any of those things. Not once did he touch her. Can you believe this? He wanted to see the labs. And yes, the labs came back. And she had cancer. So you can say, well, he didn't need to touch her. He could make the diagnosis without touching her. So is that all we do? We should have the ultrasound tech just ultrasound everybody with ascites and decide what the diagnosis is. We can do that. As a matter of fact, AI can do that probably better than I can, right? So we have the computer just look at the stuff and give the diagnosis. So Flexner won. And so for decades, that's what dominated Western medicine. They were using a model that we call the biomedical model. Thank God it was supplanted by another model, which was the biopsychosocial model, and then there's still something missing from there. So let me go a little bit further. These were some of the effects of the Flexner report, and on the upper right corner, you see the body he saw as a machine. The body is formed of machinery to be fixed by medical doctors. That's what he saw. The mind and the body were separate. He took the Descartesian view. We don't need to worry about the mental stuff and the social stuff and whatnot. Today, we say, yes, we have to be considerate of those things. Today, we say that's an essential part. But it took a while for us to get there. Yeah, we had this this very interesting little model where the affective was out the window and the cognitive was all that mattered. And yes, we had all these various theories as to what should be done in the biomedical model and how we can get to a correct diagnosis. But thank God, there have been interesting individuals or interested individuals who started to do research on this thing that we call compassionate care. And that changed the practice of medicine. So many of you who are youngsters still, that is, you're less than 70 years of age, you have benefited from some of this research. Because the inflection point was somewhere in the early 2000s that the research on compassion just took off. So today, we're benefactors of this. The definitions: empathy, sympathy, compassion in medicine, intertwined. Very difficult to study correctly, but the working definitions do well for us. And the model, the biopsychosocial model, takes into account the other aspects of human life that affect illness and affect the manifestation of disease. Doctors, then, are what doctors were supposed to be in the beginning. That is, people who take care of people, not people who take care of disease. A doctor is a specialist in taking care of people, not taking care of just disease. But when we confront suffering, we have different responses. And this is just the short list of responses that we could have. Some people, because of how they have been oriented and other aspects of their life, I'm not going to go into all of that, treat it with indifference. They observe suffering, and it doesn't affect them one way or another. Okay? Sometimes what we find is that people who have been in medicine for a long time, they end up looking at suffering with indifference. And that's a sad situation. It's about time to decide you're going to hang up your stethoscope when you're indifferent to the suffering of others. Others have this detached concern, which is what many have learned. You know, you're concerned, but you're at a distance, right? You're not going to let this thing affect you with any to any great degree. And then there's some who deal with things with sympathy. They feel, oftentimes to the point of being unable to act, because they're so distraught by what's going on. This occupies most of their time and their thinking. And then there are those who deal with things with compassion. They are moved by the suffering, and they desire and act to relieve the suffering. And then there are some who withdraw. They see what's going on, it affects them, and their action is, I'm out of here. Have somebody else take care of that. Some of the changes that we've seen over the years in people practicing in different specialties lead us to think that the idea of indifference and withdrawal is real among physicians, because we're human too. For many years, people in emergency medicine would last, I mean, the average was about 10 years in the ER, and then they would switch to doing something else. So the specialty change rate for emergency medicine was pretty high. The capacity to actually feel that something is happening with someone else is something that develops from the time of birth. And we now have neuropsychological and neuroanatomical correlates to people who feel empathy or feel compassion. So there's actually something happening in our brains. And we all have the ability from childhood to empathize, that is to feel the suffering of someone else. Part of the issue is how we develop the ability to understand that that suffering is not me and or that suffering is me. And babies oftentimes can't make that distinction. So a baby can see something happening and begin to cry as if it were happening to them. Well, part of the reason is because we have neural networks in our brains that actually observing something causes a response in us. In the same part of the brain, by observing it as if it were happening to us. Okay? Those of you who are familiar with mirror neurons understand this, but now it's even much wider than just neurons. It's the whole networks in our brains, in different parts of the brain that are able to respond to these things. During adolescence, we have this this blurring. So during adolescence, young people are being learning how to distinguish between, you know, John is having a problem, it is not my problem, right? And then by the time we are adults, we're able to distinguish that is John's problem and this is my problem. We have different problems, right? But being able to distinguish those two may lead to one saying, well, that's John's problem, I don't have anything to do with it. And that's where the compassion comes in. Compassion is going beyond just knowing that I am not the one that's suffering. The other is suffering, and I am desirous to help that. But the biopsychosocial model lacks a very significant component. And there isn't much literature about that other component. Can you tell me what that component might be? I'm hearing some whispers. The spiritual. So our model is actually the biopsychosocio-spiritual model. And there aren't too many people talking about that. And some of it, some of the articles that exist, they are not talking about spirituality the way we talk about it. They're using a much broader, more mystical approach to this. And I need to go faster. My clock is telling me. Yeah. So we have to be able to integrate the spiritual here, but it's not just the spiritual. We have to integrate in our model our brand of spirituality, which we believe is God's brand of spirituality. Okay? So people have developed curricula looking at compassion training in medical education. And in this particular study, they were trying to look and see if there were specific skills and behaviors that should be taught to students. What do you think? You think we should teach students how to be compassionate? What do you think? Resounding yes? Yes, I would agree with you, all right? And look at the methods of training that are most effective. So you don't want to waste your time doing things that won't actually produce the outcome that you want. And what they did was they found that the things that had the most benefit were actual patients. okay, working with actual patients and video recordings of interviews with actual patients, they had a 100% success rate in this review compared to other forms of teaching. It showed improvement in at least one of the outcome measures of compassion. So actually working with people or having a record of how people were worked with. You know, that kind of rings a bell with me. How did Jesus teach? Did he just stand up and lecture to his disciples? This is what you must do, this is what you must do. What did he do? He went around with them. He showed them how to minister, right? And they caught it. Yeah. They also read the record. And when there were any disputes, he would ask the question, how do you read it? How do you see it? Right? And then he would be able to help correct. So I think that, you know, the fact that this research is showing this is just telling me we're on the right track here, right? There are some skills that will help the patient to perceive that we are actually being compassionate with them. When I was a medical student, we were told the dogma was do not sit on the patient's bed. Did anybody hear that? Don't sit on the patient's bed. How many of you respect that 100%? Nobody. Oh, we have one person who respects it. You must be working in the OR. Let me tell you, there are countless studies where patients, when the doctor sits with them on the edge of the bed, you know, not sitting on their legs or something, or not crowding them, or that they feel that there's more closeness. But you don't have to do that. You can pull up a chair, right? The idea is that you sit. What they showed is that sitting is better than standing, right? Detecting and commenting on what's going on with the patient begins to feel that you are actually seeing me. Recognizing and responding to opportunities for compassion. So the person says that they're in pain, and you say, yeah, you know, that procedure is a tough one to take. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just words, right? But it shows something. Also, nonverbal communication of caring. Touching the patient's feet. Touching a shoulder. Some patients, they want a hug, okay? So, I've given patients hugs. I'm a geriatrician. I have gotten those slobbering kisses of edentulous women who decide that I am their favorite doctor in the whole world. Right? Yeah. It works. The touch. And incorporating statements of support. Like, I'm here for you. We're in this together. Yeah, truly, we're in this together. I am not going through what you're going through, but we're in it together. The common denominator, true physician presence and focus, that we're there with them and that we're focusing on them. Full attention and support. This study was looking at empathy declining and barriers. What they showed was that as students come in the first year, they have little barriers to show empathy. But as they go through their clinical years, more and more barriers present themselves so that their empathy and their compassion decreases during medical education. Isn't that something? Yeah. cultivating compassion through training, they showed that modeling compassion is the way to go. So faculty, those of you who are mentors or faculty members, there is the power of being able to show what this looks like should not be underestimated. Show compassion. What they have shown is that by doing so, you also help the trainees to address issues of burnout. And they're actually more well for learning about this. There are some intricate models that boil down to similar things. The patient is one person, we are another person, we interface with that individual. They have a need, we're trying to help with that need. And our interactions as people and also as professionals ultimately lead to the patient's perception of what is going on and how they will deal with their illness. There are different ways of being able to train, as we mentioned. And in this study, they said it shouldn't be just something, a one-off. It's something that we need to be intentional about in training programs. We need to be intentional about that in schools, in medical schools, in residency programs, in hospitals. We need to be intentional. In this particular case, they have this huge, complex array of things that are involved. But I would like to suggest that we have a few issues that we can deal with that show the benefits, if you will, of compassion and compassionate care. Arguably, the greatest indicator of quality health care, according to patients and family members, they highlight the impact of compassion in their care. The symptom burden is decreased, the quality of life is increased, hospital length of stay decrease, satisfaction with care increase. In other words, think about it from the legal standpoint, less likelihood of even lawsuit. Healthcare provider patient relationship, they feel, I can relate to this doctor, and even to think that we've become friends, right? Patient disclosure. Patients are more willing to tell you about what's going on and what the real problems are when you are compassionate with them. Cooperation and compliance. There are many patients who don't even fill the prescriptions that you write and that I write, right? What they have shown is that when the patient perceives high compassion by the physician, they're more likely to comply with what the physician is saying, more likely to get the medication, more likely to follow up with the treatments, etc., right? The management of the health issues, less pain medication use, even the healthcare costs are decreased. What else? Among healthcare providers, there are some benefits when we apply this compassionate care. Better physician-patient relationship, enhanced workplace well-being, lower physician and staff burnout, less job fatigue, job satisfaction. All of these have been shown in the research. Greater physician and staff resilience and greater physician and staff retention. As professional healthcare Christians, compassionate care should be our trademark. And there's some practical ways to increase this compassionate care. We need to plead for the indwelling of the Holy Spirit as Christians. Our greatest need. We need to practice the presence of God because God is always in the audience. There's a good little book called The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. It's a classic. It might be worth your getting. I'm sure you can get it on one of the online libraries. We need to reject and avoid hurriedness, even in the face of busyness. And we need to tame our busyness. Immerse ourselves in the ocean of compassion and the sea of comfort through studying the life of Christ, seeing how he did it. He is our mentor. He's the model that we're following. We can imitate Christ and practice compassion and comfort. And when we are with the patient, we need to be present ourselves. Not there, but we're somewhere else. And I'm going to take you to the end of the slide to point this out. In the studies done to see what you can do to help your patients to know that you have compassion for them, it took only 40 seconds. 40 seconds of being able to mention the things that they care about to let them know that you care about them. So here is what one patient said. And as I left his office, he said, "You know, you have a very bad disease, but we're going to take care of you." The doctor-patient relationship was incredibly therapeutic and reassuring. This is what the patient said. "I had no qualms, no doubts about putting my life in his hands. I had full confidence in his expertise, his concern, and his emotional support." I think this was a wonderful statement, but I can think of a statement that would be even better. What if, after everything was said and done, this is what that patient said? And as I left his office, he said, "You know, you have a very bad disease, but by God's grace, we're going to take care of you, and He will not leave you." She would say the doctor-patient relationship was incredibly therapeutic and reassuring, and I was in God's hands. I had no qualms, no doubts about putting my life in my God-fearing doctor's care. I had full confidence in his expertise, his concern, and his emotional and spiritual support." I pray that that's how our patients will refer to us after we leave the room. God bless you.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.